Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, Yoga Conversations for Smart, Compassionate Practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine. Hi, podcasters. I'm so happy to be back. It's been an incredibly busy month, and it has been an excellent reminder to not overschedule my summer. We always get this impression that summer is the season of ease, but summer is the season of scheduling. And from the Ayurvedic lens, it's governed by Pitta Dosha, which means that overscheduling is definitely going to be exacerbated, and it's going to be a little intense. And all those visions that you have of pleasant experiences, you're going to ruin them by trying to do too much at specific times in specific ways. You A-type people, you know what I'm talking about. We're going to have fun, damn it. Anyway, this month has reminded me not to do that so much to my family. Today, I'm sharing with you a conversation with Hallie Schwartz, who you will so enjoy for the ease and lightness with which she brings to some really interesting, heavy, deep philosophical concepts. Hallie is originally from Montreal, Quebec, Canada, where her mother encountered a visiting Swami who set up for a while to give some lectures. And Hallie shares how she was so small that she attended these lectures as well. And ultimately, her mother ended up moving to India. And so Hallie has grown up living in Canada, visiting India, and ultimately studying there herself. She went in 1988 for the first time to the ashram where her mother had decided to live her life. And she's gone there every year since, delving into all aspects of the yoga tradition at the International Meditation Institute in Kullu in the northwestern Himalayas. It's the institute where she was introduced to yoga philosophy, and she studied the Sanskrit language, several yoga and Vedantic scriptures, as well as chanting, meditation, hatha yoga, kriya, and restorative yoga. But she has since moved to Toronto, and that's where she started teaching her studies in 1999. And so she studied Ashtanga yoga with Ron Reed at Downward Dog, and in 2001 began teaching philosophy, Sanskrit, chanting, and meditation in various teacher trainings around the city, which she still does at studios such as Yoga Space, Yoga Sanctuary, Octopus Garden, I Am Yoga, and Sananda Yoga. In 2002, Hallie started leading pilgrimage voyages to India, which you can join her on to various sites in the country and the Himalayas. I think you will really enjoy this conversation if you have even a little bit of interest in yoga philosophy, not to mention such a unique introduction to yoga in Canada anyway. Hallie and I have a conversation about different aspects of philosophy as well as her background. And if you're interested, I will provide all links to Hallie off the show notes. And I really recommend her chants. I so enjoy her chants from the Bhagavad Gita, as well as her book, One Without a Second. Without further delay, my conversation with Hallie Schwartz. Good morning, Hallie.
Good morning, Catherine.
Thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
I've been looking forward to this conversation, which we've had in my head a few times, because we have a mutual friend, Dallas Della Hunt.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
And when I asked her, I said, so based on your recommendation, I'm having Hallie on the podcast. Do you have any particular questions?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no, I get the pleasure of listening to Hallie every fall.
That's true.
Yeah. You swing into Dallas's teacher training and do yoga philosophy.
I do. I do about 9 or 10 hours of the history of yoga philosophy, almost from its root, its inception, all the way up to yoga philosophy as it seems to appear in our world today.
And that's what you do. You do that for multiple programs in Ontario.
I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be one of the things in life that really lights me up. And I think the reason why it does that is because it's the subject matter that I'm so personally and intimately connected with. Ever since I was a little girl and my mother, it seemed by happenstance, discovered this way of living, this way of thinking, this set of teachings and principles. And it's kind of just, it's been in my lap ever since I was a young girl. So for me to communicate it and for me to talk about it feels almost as effortless as, I don't know, eating or breathing or something like that. Yeah.
I'm so excited to talk about specifics of philosophy with you. Mm-hmm. And you've already touched on where I think we should begin. My mother was also my first yoga teacher.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Although I joke that for a long time I wasn't interested in it because I thought that yoga was for middle-aged ladies with high anxiety. Which now I realize it is for middle-aged ladies with anxiety.
For anybody with anxiety.
But my mother went and became a yoga teacher. And I think it's a much more typical story. We lived in the suburbs of Toronto, and life as she was living it was not working.
Yeah.
And so she went and pursued yoga teacher training to explore and invite a shift.
Yeah.
But when your mom decided that yoga was the path, there weren't a lot of teacher trainings around Canada.
There were about zero teacher training programs in Canada in those days. It was must have been about 1971 or 1972. I was really young. And I think it was the Swami Vishnu Devananda Center that opened in Montreal, which is a kind of division of the Shivananda School. Yes. There weren't a lot of Hatha Yoga lineages in Canada in those days. I believe there was maybe the Iyengar lineage. There must have been, the Shivananda lineage. But it certainly wasn't popular the way it is today, so certainly no teacher training programs were happening in those days.
Did your mom go and check out the Shivananda Center?
She did. She actually went to the Shivananda Center in Montreal, and she took a few Hatha Yoga classes. She took to it a little bit. She thought it was interesting, and it helped. But it certainly wasn't what she was instinctively and really in her soul looking for. And so she sort of had a bit of a comme-ci, comme-ça attitude about Hatha Yoga in general until she met her teacher. By happenstance, she met her teacher, and that's when she just knew she had found that which, you know, she had been proverbially said looking for her entire life.
And what was she doing before she met her teacher, aside from parenting?
Oh, true. Very good question. She was a very successful visual artist. So she had a lot of her paintings in galleries and in some of the most popular galleries in downtown Montreal in those days. Her career was actually in a place of great success. And even though she was very happy about the success that her artistic career was happening, still there was something, you know, you always know when there's something that's sitting in the back of your head or in the back of your consciousness, that's like almost like a beeping light that just won't go away. Mm. And even though she had fabulous success with her art career, somehow it wasn't completely what she was looking for.
Michael Stone says that we need just enough suffering to get us in the door.
So true.
And so who was her teacher?
Her teacher was named Swami Sham, and he since has passed away in this last maybe 15 or 16 months. It's been about since he's kind of left this field. And he happened to be traveling in Canada in the early 1970s. And her best friend at the time, my mother's best friend at the time, had met him in one of his seminars, meditation seminars, and you could say yoga philosophy seminars, and got so excited and inspired that he asked my mother to go with him to one of those lectures, one of those sessions. And as the story goes, she refused many times because she said she had already tried lots of yoga before and it wasn't, you know, exactly what she was looking for, and she didn't didn't think that that's what, you know, it was that she needed. And finally, he just wouldn't stop bothering her. And she said, fine, you know, just to kind of get him off her back. And so she went to the lecture. And really, that's the beginning of the story. She never left from that moment on. It's almost like you, when you meet your true self, or when you recognize your true self, it's almost like your system knows that the search is over, because you found what you've been looking for.
And was Swami Shyam, so was he from India?
Yes, from India, an Indian guru. And he had been invited to Canada by, I think, a fellow named Jeff Sterling, who was the a person who was overseeing all of the operations at Shom FM in Montreal. And I believe that the teacher was invited for a series of interviews, which brought him to Montreal. And that's how it all started.
And yeah. this is how much of yoga started in North America. It was not uncommon for gurus to come and promote their teachings and their ashrams. Am I correct? This is what I've
read
anyway.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. You're correct. I believe this was just a tiny bit different, because I think the Guruji at that point was responding to a very specific set of circumstances vis-a-vis interviews for a radio station. But what happened is that the word got spread out in the community, certainly in the Montreal area. And more people started coming, because this friend told somebody, and then a friend told somebody, and all of a sudden there were circumstances for teaching, for satsangs, as we usually say in Sanskrit, that was not the original intention of the reason why this particular Guruji came to Canada in the first place. So it was almost like it just happened. It developed in a way that I don't think anybody had originally intended. And by the time my mother met this teacher, I think there was already about 20 or 30 people that were going to regular meditation meetings or satsangs, regular philosophy meetings, scripture study, discussion, by the time my mother had met him, which I think was somewhere around 1972. And I was so young at the time, I was not yet in full-time school, that my mother was taking me with her everywhere she went. And so, again, it was almost like, you could say in air quotes, an accident that I fell into these teachings, because my other two sisters were old enough to be in school full time, but yet I wasn't. So I was introduced to it when I was about 3 or 4 years old.
And there were no iPads to entertain you through the satsang.
Oh, Catherine, that is such a fantastic point. No, there was nothing to entertain me except for all the people that were there. And I was a very precocious child, very expressive, very open, very friendly. And so all the people that were already there participating in the satsang, they were delighted by me and I was delighted by them. And there was lots of laughter, because everybody was in the process of, you could say, opening. And so everybody's attitudes, everyone's mood, everyone's space was in such a place of great inspiration, that the dynamic of conversation, the dynamic of connection was free-flowing. And there were no distractions. There was only each other.
I think that's so lovely, because one of the things that makes me sad about the way yoga communities currently function is that they are functioning much like all other consumerist areas of our world, in that if you are not a paying adult customer, you're not welcome. We don't make space for children. And being a new mom, I have come to appreciate that outside of libraries, there's nowhere to go with a small child.
Yeah.
Unless you are a paying customer.
Oh gosh, it was so different back then. I think in 1972 or 1973, the economics of the world was, I guess you could say, similar in some ways, but in certain fundamental ways, very different. And so we just went freely. Well, my mother brought me freely everywhere. She brought me to the art galleries. She brought me everywhere she was going. And I believe that the communication between adults and children was also a little bit different in those years. Somehow, I was considered in my very loose memories because I was so young, but I have a distinct memory of feeling included because it was almost as if they recognized that the natural wisdom of the child had somehow been educated out of them. So it's almost like the natural wisdom of the child was being called upon. It was being asked for. And I can certainly remember one of the first questions that as a very young child I asked of the teacher. He asked me, if you had a question for a teacher, what would you ask? And because I was so very close and attached to my mother in those days, I actually asked the teacher, and I can remember this distinctly, who has more to learn, my mother or me? And he said, your mother. And I didn't know it at the time, but with an adult intellect, ruminating on it so many years later, I realized that as adults, often we have so much to unlearn. And it's that unlearning that is the real learning. Whereas a child, you don't have as much to unlearn. You still have that playfulness. You still have those bright eyes that when you fail at something, you kind of giggle and get up and continue. There isn't that deep field of impressions that are sitting in your head that are kind of from the back, causing you to do all kinds of things and you don't even know where it's coming from. You know, there's that.
We were chatting about this last night, not this specifically, but we were chatting about the sutras last night in my teacher training. And we were talking about the challenge of knowing the description, or at least the most accurate description different adepts and scholars provide, of what enlightenment looks like and what it might feel like. And so we have this destination, and by virtue of its loftiness, assume it is not for us.
Very true. Well put. Well put, Catherine. Yeah. I think we think that it's not for us because there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about what it is. And I think for the longest time, I misunderstood the destination, the goal, as you put it. I misunderstood it as well. I had this idea that this destination called variously freedom, release, awakening, liberation, all of the English terms that we have to put to the very specific Sanskrit terms. I have this idea that it meant the end of emotionality, the end of the way in which we react to being a human being. So I remember checking with my teacher at one of the times that I was spending some time living in the ashram in the Himalayas, and I remember saying, the surest sign of my own state of awakening is when I completely stop suffering. And he said, no, 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 no. He said, you can weep and cry and still be enlightened. I swear I almost fell off my chair. I'm not even joking. I was so taken aback, I didn't know what to say. And then, of course, years later, ruminating about it, I realized that the enlightenment state is not the absolute absence of suffering. It's the absence of identification with that suffering. So the wave of suffering might still arise, but what stops happening is the latching on or the identifying to with my I am to that state of suffering. So that I'm recognizing the state, but I'm not identifying with it. And that's what I'm really trying to unfold, I feel, in my own practice. I'm not trying to push away the thoughts. I'm not trying to push away what my mind says is the opposite of liberation. I'm trying to really see the wave of it as it arises, and seeing and trying to see that me, sometimes called Atman in Sanskrit, sometimes called the Purush in Sanskrit, I'm trying to see that the true self is ever free of it, even as it arises.
I'm thinking something I like to talk about with with my groups is the concept of social comparison. Mm-hmm. And it's a socio-psychological concept that it's terribly exacerbated by social media.
Yeah.
And it's the idea that we view ourselves in comparison to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, fear of missing out or however you want to view it, yeah. But our life is only good or worthy or attractive if it is superior to other people's yeah. states. And of course, yeah. this is then compounded by the myriad of images we see on a daily basis that are totally unrealistic.
Yeah.
I look at some really beautiful Instagram feeds of mothers wearing all white in their all white homes.
Oh my God.
With their children dressed in all white. And I think, have you just shoved all your mess into one corner?
Yeah. But I think we do that. I think we do that in our homes because we do that in our primary home, which is our mind. Mm. And if you're going to do it in the primary home, which is your sense of I am, your ego identity, your personality construct, your whole idea of past, present, and future and me, if you're going to do it in the subtle environment, which is the inner environment, of course you're going to do it in the external environment. Because truly the internal environment and the external environment only are seemingly different, and in fact they're not different. One is just the grosser version of the subtler other one. Does that make sense?
It does. We were talking about that last night because the reason I bring up social comparison is that, again, I think, you know, the same way you fell off your chair when you found out that suffering would still happen.
Yeah.
We are looking at other beings and thinking, you know, that will not be for me because that is what it looks like. And then we impose on it what it must feel like.
I wonder if it's because we don't have the best living examples of that state of integration. Maybe that's even a better word than enlightenment in this context, because integration is that it's a living awareness. It's an awareness that's living inside the context of being a human being. It's not an apart state or an apart awareness. It's a living, breathing, evolving awareness. And because maybe we don't have a lot of examples for it, we use the best examples that we can find, which is the perfect face or the perfect career or the perfect look, which of course doesn't exist because it's easy to construct and then show. Like you said, it's easy to show the one corner because you can put the lens of your camera there, i.e. the camera of your eyes or the camera of your camera. You can put it there and not have to look at what's happening everywhere else. So at the absence of living examples, I wonder if we're just guessing. I feel like I've had a living example, my mother, my own mother and my own teacher. And so I feel like I am in a way comparing myself to those two living examples, but not as if those living examples are separate from me. I recognize that they are me. You know what I mean?
Do you feel, because ultimately your mom moved to India.
She did, yes.
Do you feel that you need to be a living example to move out of this culture?
That's the it question of all the it questions. So a first answer in the way I personally understand it, a first answer to that question would be when you don't have the direct experience of really living that state of awareness, sometimes, at least initially, it might be important to pull yourself out of an actual environment that doesn't support that which you're working on. So we have the term, of course, sannyas or renunciation in Indian philosophy. And that renunciation in the beginning, really at the initial stages of the practice, that renunciation might take the form of actually physically leaving an environment and going to an environment that's quieter and more supportive. But after a while of even being in that other retreat space, in that other location, when you realize that the state of awareness is within and without, because it's one, It's not two. Then it doesn't matter where you are. But I really believe in the beginning, until you realize that, sometimes you have to pull yourself out of environments that don't support where you're trying to arrive or what you're trying to unfold.
Last night we were talking about, we were coming back to the Mahagunas or the Trigunas. And I love the rabbit hole of philosophy. Admittedly, yeah. I will go down and down and down and thoroughly enjoy myself, really grappling with whether it's dualism or non-dualism. And
That question never ends.
But for my teacher trainees, for my students, I really feel the need to pull it back consistently to lived experience. Because one of them, hi, Lori, said, you know, why do we need to study this? If it's not our culture and it's not always written in a way that a modern mind can understand. And so I was talking about the gunas and I said, for me, watching the play of the qualities of energy in the universe, which we know are reflected in our minds, it helps me just drive a wedge, just a little bit of spaciousness in between my experience and my action.
Wow. Nicely put, Catherine. Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if taking ourselves out of, right, that taking yourself out of the unsupportive environment, it's driving a wedge.
It's interesting that your friend or your student used the word culture. Because I think you said she had said something that it's not the culture that we particularly come from. But for me, the way I describe culture in this context is the human culture. And the human culture is fully, absolutely, without a doubt in my mind, universal. Because when every person wakes up in the morning after a deep sleep state where there's no more I am this person, everybody wakes up to I am such and such. We all wake up to that. And so therefore that ego identity, that personal identity, doesn't live in any location geographically in terms of our Earth planet, and it doesn't live in any time signature in terms of 5,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago or today. It's absolutely universal. That's really the human culture that I believe yoga philosophy is talking about. And so when we're looking at the gunas, we're looking at everybody who wakes up in the morning with an ego identity subject to a certain kind of law, if you will. Just like the law of gravity, if you're living on the earth plane, you're subject to that law, and there's not really anything you can do about it unless you go to sleep at night in the deep sleep state, and then it's not, you're not aware of it anymore. So you're absolutely right that the way to almost make some space between this person here and all of the experiences that I'm attached to is just that space of becoming aware, is becoming aware of the culture that you wake up in the morning with, the culture that we all wake up in the morning with. And when we do have that space, we realize that the one who is just watching it all take place is not subject to any of it. For me, that's the thing that waked me up. And I have to remind myself in every moment. And I don't need to leave Toronto and my busy life in order to realize that, because that realization is me. And so I can be anywhere with it. But in the beginning, boy, did I need a lot of quiet time in order to make space for it.
Yeah. And you did that by also going to India. So did you move with your mom when you were little?
No, because I was not allowed. My father didn't permit it at the time. Of course, I totally understand why, because I was so, so young. It wasn't until I was about 17 or 18 that I was able to move a little bit more freely. So starting at about 17 or 18, I was kind of moving back and forth between Montreal and India, and then later Vancouver in India, when I lived for a few years in Vancouver. And then, of course, after that, Toronto in India. So I spent most of my teenage life, and certainly most of my 20s and part of my 30s, sort of living in the two worlds. And it's so interesting when people say things like East and West. And geographically, East and West is a very valid dichotomy or comparison. And spiritually and mentally, it also is a valid comparison. But I realize now that East and West, if you're going to use those terms, for example, they exist in the human consciousness. I really see that now. And East and West is not necessarily the words that I would choose. I would use the words that I maybe would choose would be that place where I'm connected, that state of awareness where I'm connected, and that state of awareness where I have to disconnect in order to live in this context. Yeah? In order to live in this context, in a way, I have to disconnect in order to go through the responsibilities of my day. So I used to make a split between East and West, between connection and non-connection. But I don't do that as much anymore because I realize that it's all connection, but sometimes it shows up or it'll appear as non-connection. And I feel that's where the Sanskrit term, the Vedantic term Maya, comes in. Maya is an appearance of something that's already fundamentally what it is or real. And so I don't have a problem with Maya anymore because I don't have a problem with that way in which we see things as separate. I don't have a problem with it anymore because I recognize its purpose. And
interesting. Okay, so my exposure to the word Maya is through Mahamaya. Mm-hmm. But I had understood it as the great delusion.
Yes. So yes, it absolutely is Mahamaya. You could say the great delusion or the great illusion of separateness. But if we are looking at the Vedantic standpoint of non-dualism, not two, then we realize that even Maya, if we're going to, let's say for a moment, we accept that not two or oneness is the fundamental reality, then we would have to assert that even Maya is coming from that one indivisible absolute reality. So that Maya is not some separate delusion thing that's kind of coming at my head and enveloping my intellect with wrong thinking. It's actually a power that's coming from the very me, who is one without a second, that it's coming from me and I get to fashion it in the way that I see fit, which means I enter into my human relationships. I enter into my ego identity because that Maya power is coming from the very me to begin with. And then I don't feel so victimized by it or so like puppeteered by it.
I was going to say, because often people encounter these concepts and it challenges that story of I, me, mine-ness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they feel hopeless.
Well, I think those emotional reactions are also Maya, of course, because if we are going to believe this for a moment, this one without a second, we say that emotional reality is all part of the perfection. And when we start to know how to use our reactive states, and a feeling of hopelessness is a legitimate and soulful reactive state. When we know how to recognize these reactive states, then we start seeing what's on the other side of them. And so I feel that real spirituality is not telling us not to be emotional. Lately, I've been feeling that this is a chronic misunderstanding of spirituality, is to think that these reactive states stop coming. What if I could use this state of hopelessness? What if I can use it? What if I could see it for what it is, thereby adding it to my practice, rather than rejecting it from my practice, adding it to my practice? I wonder what that would look like.
Adding yoga philosophy to practice is a big component of what you do.
Yes.
And you've mentioned the phrase one without a second, mm-hmm. which is the name of your book.
It is. It is the name of my book. Yeah.
And book is a collection of critical yoga philosophy concepts.
Yes, it is. It started out as really just being a manual for all the yoga teacher training programs that I teach. I kept on recommending my students for years and years, buy this book, buy this book. And then I realized that I had been evolving this knowledge from a real cellular level from when I was so young. And I was always using the excuse that I'm too busy teaching in order to write my book. And one day I just decided I was not going to let that excuse, you know, dictate me anymore. And so I started writing. And the book's original intention was to be almost like a survey of Indian philosophy from what I called its seed state all the way out to its sprout state, which is kind of like modernism or yoga today. And I drew the arc as best as I could in 240 pages. I drew the arc from the seed or the inception of yogic philosophical thought coming from inner seeking to where we feel yoga has landed in our laps as a modern culture today. Yeah.
And you did a terrific job. If anyone
Thank
who
you.
Is listening runs a teacher training and does not feel confident with this particular content, they should hire you, or they should,
or
they
you.
Should include your book in yeah. the curriculum.
Yeah.
And then I'll ask a question, which I'm probably more interested in than some of the listeners, but you
okay.
said it's a survey and you've uh-huh. mentioned Vedanta. So my understanding mm-hmm. is that there's six schools of Hindu philosophy.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Two, Vedanta and Sankhya. Are really the most influential in terms of modern yoga culture.
And the third, which is actually called yoga itself, but specifically referring to Patanjali's Raja Yoga, as is exposed in Yoga Darshan or the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali.
But Vyasa, the commentator, the one
yes.
who writes the commentary
yes.
on the Yoga Sutras, he brings a Sankhya Yoga philosophy lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I find only up until recently I got the connection between the Sankhya philosophy and the yoga practice or the yoga philosophical methodology. Mm-hmm. Only very recently, when I realized that the Samkhya philosophy is what maybe we would call in philosophical schools ontology, which is the description of the categories of reality as reality appears to, we say, a human being in the waking state. How does reality land for us in our awareness? And the Samkhya philosophy, as we know, says that the way reality lands for this human consciousness is that it lands as two. It lands as that free, eternally free witnessing consciousness called Purush, and everything in time, space, and causality that this Purush, this free Purush witnesses. So everything in time and change, and they call it Prakriti. And that the interesting thing about it is not it. It's that the reason why a human being, the seed cause of the suffering and ignorance that a human being often finds themselves subject to or involved in, is when that Purush and the Prakriti get mixed together totally, so that now Purush, the eternally free witnessing consciousness, comes to absolutely identify with the vehicle in which it rides and can't get out of the car, as it were. Yoga comes around and says, Patanjali comes around and says, this is what it's like to not be able to get out of the car. And this is how we can begin to open the door, first to recognize that we're in the car and can't get out of it. This is how we can start to open the door and gradually get out of the vehicle so we can see the vehicle is the vehicle. And I'm just that one who can use the vehicle but isn't the vehicle.
Yes.
And that's where I feel the relationship between Samkhya and yoga are so well. It's like yoga is the how-to, if you will. It's the practical guide of how to release yourself from the natural position you find yourself in.
This is where I like the marriage of Sankhya yoga philosophy and Ayurveda. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the principles of Sankhya yoga philosophy, it comes down to, you know, here is how you embody on this plane of prakriti.
Mm-hmm.
And you have senses. And yes. Those senses are responsible for translating your experience to your mind. And so mm-hmm. then I say to everyone, this is why we practice, and this is why we practice our Ayurvedic Dinacharya or our daily ritual.
Right.
It's to cleanse our senses so that we're having healthy interactions with reality.
Mm-hmm. Wow, amazing. And it's so interesting that you bring that up, because so much of what the original aims of Hatha Yoga or Kriya Yoga, many of the original aims and intentions of the Hatha Yoga and Kriya Yoga were exactly for that, to purify our relationship to ourselves systemically. And of course, the five senses are part of that system. And when we're able to do that, and the system that we live in, the vehicle in which we live, is operating according to a place of greater integrity and harmony, the ability to see what's real becomes, I guess, more accessed, easier.
Mm.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And in modern Hatha Yoga, I guess, maybe one of the smaller critiques that I would have against modern Hatha Yoga, even though I really love it and there's so much about it I'm so grateful for, one of the initial critiques I would have of Hatha Yoga was that somehow we've taken one apple from the tree and then put it down there on the yoga mat and said, that's Hatha Yoga, and yet the tree is full of all these unbelievably ripe apples that are ready for our consuming, ready for our smelling, ready for our knowing, but we've kind of taken one apple from the tree and we said this is what Hatha Yoga is, and therefore it's taking, I think, a little bit longer for the system to become purified or for the system to become balanced, because we're only consuming one aspect of it or one or two aspects of it.
I like that you are light and also metaphorical in your sharing that there is more to be had. And I say that because there seems to me a stark divide between ancient and modern yoga scholarship,
right,
and practitioners.
Yeah.
Like almost a level of derision,
yeah,
and suspicion that a lot of academics bring to this lens, to which I'm always confused, because mm-hmm. if you are so knowledgeable and you are so gifted to live a life where study is your career, how can you not create space for compassion and education?
Right. What an amazing point. For the longest time, I was a little less light than I am right now about this subject.
Yoga teachers always get grumpy eventually, right? We all go through that grumpy phase where we're like, I've had it.
I've come out the other side of it, because I'm always remembering words from my two main teachers, which are my mother and my own Guruji. And something that my Guruji said was, and this is hard to swallow, it's not an easy one to take. He said, if you complain, then you have to improve. And so I realized that it's not up to so-called everybody else to understand Hatha Yoga or the real yoga, and then all of a sudden I'm going to feel happy. I have to understand that it's this consciousness that has to shift, because this is the only consciousness that I have dominion over. And so I understand that now. So that's caused some of my heaviness to go away. And then the other thing that my mother said in response to one of Ruiz's four agreements, which is always do your best.
Yeah.
She said, Hallie, one thing I need to let you know, everybody is always just doing their best. Oh, that just completely blew my mind, because everybody is working according to the present capacity that they have. Everybody is just unfolding what is there inside them to naturally be able to unfold. And when I really started to imbibe or live those two teachings, I some of my derision just loosened a little bit. Yeah.
Yes.
And now I realize that sometimes your personality is the last thing to go. Your opinions, your ideas, your concepts, some of the ways in which you don't live what you know to be true, that the confines of the personality, sometimes it's the very last thing to go, even as you're working towards your own emancipation or awakening. So it's made me feel much more compassionate, not towards others, towards myself.
Something that my current assistant reminded me of when this query, it was actually during the Bhagavad Gita evening, when this query about why to study came up, and Catherine said, I think you need to remember that it's a text, it's a lens. We can use it to study our own experience, and it is a reminder that all things are cyclical.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I think as teachers, as practitioners, we frequently, we get, again, back to Maya, back to delusion, illusion. We don't realize that we are having a conversation with ourselves. We're having a conversation with our students, but they are constantly cycling in and out where we are always in that conversation. So you always are beginning the conversation again. Every time you meet a new person who is simply doing your yoga class, and I don't think we can confuse people who do our yoga classes as our students,
right?
And people who identify as our students. And we are not in lockstep progression on the path together.
I guess when there is a agreement that a person is coming to you in order to begin a discussion and then keep it going, then the way in which the expression takes place, the way in which the lens is explored and discovered is its own paradigm. And if there's not an agreement that yourself and the person who's come to you, who is not necessarily a student because they come to your class, the way in which the conversation is goes might be a little bit more like a straight line. Whereas when somebody comes to you as a fellow journeyer in this lens, then I think the conversation is a little bit more circular. So when I teach my satsangs, I do it. I have about six groups going on right now. It's because there is a trust relationship between myself and them that we are going to begin a conversation that is fully open-ended. And therefore, the way in which I communicate and the scriptures I choose to study and the language that I choose is according to that paradigm. And I try my best not to confuse the paradigms, because I don't want anybody to feel that I'm preaching something at them. I would hate to feel that somebody feels that I'm preaching something at them. Rather, a conversation has been started. Discovery is underway that we can together grow. We can grow that conversation together, not me growing it and you're listening to me. We grow it together. Yeah.
From the karmic perspective, if those grumpy teachers decide that they would just like to go be in a cave and elevate their own consciousness, is that my understanding has always been that that is resolving collective karma.
This is a big topic.
I know. I'm sorry. Toward the end of our conversation, I just blew
it off. Not at all. I love big topics.
Okay.
I'm kind of like, yeah, big topic. I believe if you're still under the impression that I, separate from others, I'm going to do this work to fix collective karma, then it's not possible, because the lens that you're working from is already not collective. You know, and so that's why cave consciousness, I think, is more personal transformation, because cave consciousness presupposes that you still think there's a me that has to get out of something. And when you still think there's an individual me that has to get out of something, you haven't yet opened your lens to include the universal me, i.e. the collective karma. And so I think that until you do that so-called personal transformation, there's not much you can do for that many people. Do you know what I mean?
I like that so much, because one of the criticisms I've heard leveled against yoga in comparison to Buddhism, if you were forced to choose one, is that Buddhism is about being in the world.
Uh-huh.
And yoga is about being not of the world.
Oh, well, I could understand why somebody would say that, but that's, of course, from my perspective, very reductionistic. I think that the yogis believe it's all one world. It's one without a second. It's all one world. Inner world, outer world. Maya makes it seem as like this is my world, inner world. That's the outer world, outer world. So if Maya still has you in its grips, then you're going to think that you have to leave the so-called that world in order to go to the so-called this internal world. In fact, Maya will make you think that you have to leave something in order to get somewhere. But when Maya is no longer the OS, the operating system, the way in which you see, then it doesn't matter where you are, because it's all one vision. So you cannot be in the world. You can be in the world. What's it to you at that point? So most of the, you could say, enlightened gurus or enlightened swamis or yogis or whatever word you're going to use, most of them, they don't have to leave the world, because if you leave the world, where's the world going to go? It's all one world. And then so the enlightened yogis are actually making it their mission to be of, to help to end the ignorance and suffering of all beings, which in that way lines up totally with the vows of the Bodhisattva. I receive this life and this incarnation in order to be a light to others. So, yeah.
Are they more comfortable, I believe they're the same. Are they more comfortable receiving money for their teaching? Do they just accept with perhaps greater ease and grace than we sometimes do that bills need to be paid and roofs need to be repaired?
So interesting that you asked that question. I, you know, in the old days, if you trace just strictly the history, you see that the way the let's just call it the Hindu guru tradition, just because that's kind of more my expertise, is the guru lived in the household with the family. And it was not a monetary thing. It's just that the guru lived in the household with the family. The guru was a part of the family. And the guru's role in the family, just like everybody, every particular person has their own role in the family, the guru's role in the family was to be the one that shows the absolute perspective in the context of the particular circumstances that are always in flux. So the guru's perspective was to teach the shastras, the scriptures, was to offer teachings on how to properly worship so that you cultivate the heart and spirit of love and abundance. The guru's role was to show that there is a perfection that exists even when it looks like imperfection. This was the guru's role in the context of the growth of the personal household. So in that way, it wasn't so much an exchange of monies. It was more like an exchange of energy. And then I guess if you watch the arc of the way this guru-disciple relationship changed throughout history, as our system became more paper money or coin money based, which you see through the evolution of time, the way in which we exchanged, this exchange took place naturally followed the course of monetary evolution. So nowadays, our exchanges in every walk of life are happen monetarily. And this tradition, these yoga teachings, seem to have naturally fallen that course. Although you still have many ashrams worldwide, not just in India, where it's about seva, it's energy exchange rather than money. And in, you know, Western culture, we seem to have made it about an exchange of money. I don't even know where I stand with that. Some part of me feels like I would love more than anything else to do nothing but give satsang, but to hold satsang, and to do it based on an exchange of capacity and energy. And I really see myself one day evolving into that way of teaching. Mm. How about yourself? What do you feel about that?
I struggle with sometimes feeling like I am facilitating people's productivity and accountability, you know, because we want yoga and meditation out there in the workforce. The workforce isn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so when companies acknowledge that it is more affordable and kinder, but they're more concerned with more affordable to keep people well and keep them content rather than burning them out and giving them sick leave, mm-hmm. you know, bringing in these elements of wellness, the very pragmatic tools of yoga and meditation, of course I support that. At the same time, again, it's like driving a little wedge. Can we use these tools to be in the world and to be energized to change the world?
Yeah. I wonder if everybody in this life is born with a dharma, with a set of that which they are meant to do. A set of that which, I know I'm making bad grammar here, but if we could define dharma as that which is your role, I don't like to say the word duty, that which is your role to provide in this life or to unfold in this life. And I feel that very strongly that it's my role in this life, and hardly because I chose it. I don't know if it's that I chose it or it chose me, but I feel it's my role in this life to help people see that which they already are. It's not that I'm it and they're not, and I have to somehow take it out of me and put it on them. I hope that I'm helping people realize that which they already are. And it seems that in this lifetime, I have a bit of an easier time doing that for myself than maybe other people do. And I want that expertise to be able to be of use to as many people as possible, should they decide that that's what they feel they need. And so in that, if somebody says to me, Howley, I don't have the ducats, I don't have the dineros and the coins as the exchange rate between these two things, is that okay? Of course that's okay. Do you think I'm going to refuse a person because they don't have the money to pay? And no way. But if somebody feels that this is the appropriate way to make this exchange and we do it for money, then I will accept it. But if people need these teachings and there isn't that form of exchange, I wouldn't blink an eye. Of course, I want to make these teachings available to as many people who naturally have trust in me and feel that they need it.
From my teacher, I feel that our dharma is our little corner of the universe, because it's always confused, and I used to confuse it as our vocation, right? Yeah. Back to that productivity, it's our job.
Right.
And I know that you just said that you feel this way, and I feel this way, that a large part of my dharma is helping other people hold up their little corner of the universe.
Yeah.
But the work that I think yoga teachers, people who facilitate yoga classes, need to do is to realize when they are not helping those people hold up their corner of the universe, but holding it for them.
Yeah. Oof, I know. But you know, it takes so much of doing your own work in order to have the vivek or the discernment to tell the difference between those two ways in which you're working with others. You know, it's often the complaint I get from so many passionate yoga teachers, passionately involved yoga teachers, is that there's precious little time for their own sadhana or daily practice. And I used to go through that a lot. I don't so much anymore because I realize that without it, I'm lost,
yes.
Really lost. But I find that maybe newer teachers who are just coming in and who are passionately excited about offering this to their community, what happens is there's so much compassion burnout, which is the term that I think is going around our community these days, mm-hmm. that there's just not enough prana energy in order to sustain the sadhana themselves. And I think if that is missing, the personal sadhana is missing, it's very difficult to have that vivek, that discernment between am I pushing liberation and happiness on people, or am I holding space for their own discovery for it? So I think if I lose my meditation practice, which is the most important thing in the world to me, if I lose my meditation practice, I become a talker. And I'm a good talker. But it's not my goal in life. It's not my dharma to be a talker. Yeah. It's yes. just my dharma to be somebody that helps the cycle along rather than just goes on a straight line talking at somebody. So maybe that's something I would suggest to new teachers, is to recognize what you feel your sadhana is and to stay on course.
I'm in a phase where I don't see any of my friends. So if any of my friends are listening, it's not you. It's yeah. me. I don't see any of my friends because yes. Working the quantity that I am and parenting, it's at this point, it's cleaning, socializing, or practice. And I've chosen practice. So you can't come over because my house is a mess. And I can't see you because I don't
that's
have
really
time.
Funny. But you see, that's vivek right there. That's discernment right there. You have the choices right there in front of you. No, you have the raw materials right there in front of you, and you recognize what they are. And then with your sense of knowing what helps you connect to what's real and what doesn't as much, let's say, yes. we make choices based on that sense of discernment. So sometimes things have to become second, appear to become second, while that which is first is taking care of this vessel that is needed and that is required to be of service to others.
Yes.
We can't do it all. One thing we can't do as human beings with these bodies and five senses and minds is we can't do it all because it's a finite system. You're trying to recognize the infinite in a finite system. That's a strange irony, isn't it?
Yes, but I think most people get here increasingly comfortable with it is this one way and it is also this other way.
Yeah. Well, that's evolution. You've that's growth. That doesn't happen just in a moment. That happens through a lot of struggle, a lot of getting it wrong,
yes.
a lot of mixed errors, you know what I mean?
Someone yeah. asked Someone, me recently if I had, you know, pondered something and did I have a strong opinion about it? And I said, I did. And we were chatting about this particular thing. And she said, oh, I've never heard you say anything on it. And I said, well, I'm still working with it. And I've put things out there before and been so wrong.
Yeah, and you don't mind being wrong in your own chest, but you don't want to take the wrong out of your chest and like put it all over people. That's irresponsible. And that's where the personal sadhana comes in, because personal sadhana often happens in stillness and silence, often does. And that's where you get to cycle through your own ideas and your own concepts, and it comes up, and you can do that swadhyaya, that self-study, mm-hmm. that self-reflection. Yeah.
Well, I think the other thing I'm thinking of is we're putting so much out there in social media, on our websites. Here's what I know. Come practice with me, etc. And similar to what you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, I hope that people who have achieved that level of integration, they are not without knowing that they have been wrong. Maybe they're not wrong anymore, but they're not without knowing that they have been wrong.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to be disappointed in ourselves and our teachers if we are looking for someone who has never been wrong or at least never admitted or published their wrong opinion.
I guess you should run as far as possible in the other direction when you meet somebody who says they've never been wrong. I mean, that might be, people always say to me, how do I know when I'm going to find my guru, my teacher? How am I going to know? And I think there are certain markers for somebody that you can trust and somebody that you can't trust. And I believe that there is a marker, there's a signpost for somebody that maybe you can't trust. And it's when there is no admission that they got it wrong and that they fell on their face and that they made errors. And that certainly would be a marker for me. Yeah. Yeah.
Your teacher has moved on, has he not?
Yeah. He left this incarnation and he left the body and went to the absolute from which he always was and never left. I mean, my perspective is that when you drop your body, you return to not a different place. You're just in a place that you always were, but you're no longer squished into a protracted, limited, time-bound system. And it's not just Buddhists and Hindus that believe that. You know, if you look at the inner essence of all the faiths and philosophies and religions, it's all saying the same thing. You know, if you look at quantum science, which is something that I'm passionately interested in these last maybe 4 or 5 years, you realize it's one single field of consciousness, single field of awareness that's going through changes in time and space. But just because the changes are occurring in time and space, it doesn't mean the infinite field is changing at all. And so I feel that when the body dies, the being that always was doesn't go through any changes, only the system changes. So that's kind of what I'm turning. That's how I console myself when these macro changes, like death is a macro change, when these macro changes take place and you can't help but feel sad and missing and weep real tears of water that come out of your eyes. So I still do that. I still actually weep real tears of water coming out of my eyes. But even when I do that, I feel like I don't forget. I don't forget. I feel like I'm still in a place of remembering, even while I'm reacting. I hope.
Do you feel satisfied with the teaching that you have had in this life? Do you have other teachers?
I feel so satisfied. I feel blessed. I feel so lucky. Do I have other teachers? Oh my gosh, I have other teachers. Not only physically, my mother is still alive and she was here in Toronto with me for 6 months and she left to go back to the ashram in India maybe about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. But because of these amazingly vibrant satsangs that I have all the time, these philosophy meetings that I have and these teacher trainings that I do, I am constantly inspired by the so-called students. I am constantly inspired. In fact, I'm in awe of the people that I work with. And I love that you brought up this cycle, this circle between yourself and the student, not a straight line, not an I'm here and there, but a conversation that is constantly evolving. I feel that that's happening so much these days in my own work, that there's nowhere the teacher isn't. There's nowhere the teacher isn't. I wish I could find a place the teacher isn't. Okay, maybe the deep sleep state when there's no more I am Hallie. Maybe the teacher isn't there because I'm not there. But I just see him, it, that, you, me. I see it everywhere.
I want to end with one last big question, or perhaps okay. Maybe just a comment.
Okay.
One of my inspirations spent a long time in India in an ashram, and this person teaches professionally and should be, has so much to offer, but expressed some frustration, some sadness when they said that when they travel and when they teach, people always ask them for their teacher's name. Yeah. So they can go travel and learn from that person, yeah, as if it's closer to authenticity, closer to the source. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because I think that women in particular, I mean, from a young age, we are derided for not being authorities. Mm-hmm. You know, the ultimate example of posturing and pretense is a young woman coming into adolescence, into adulthood, mm-hmm. right? That valley girl voice. Mm-hmm. That's what's always held up as the least authentic or authoritative voice in our culture. Of course, there are other voices as well. And I do believe in intersectional study, but that is one of the voices that is held up.
Mm-hmm. The distinction. Yeah.
And so I think it's so important that we sit and learn from strong women and that we give them a seat of authority.
I'm hearing your point and I'm hearing your question. In so many ways, I do identify with being a strong woman. I do. But only in some ways do I identify with being a strong woman. I maybe first identify with being a strong being, second, a strong person, and maybe third, a strong woman. I wonder if that's maybe an unpopular opinion in current politics. But I feel like the fact that I got incarnated as a woman and a very strong woman, it's true, I have been incarnated as a strong woman, makes me take my role as a strong woman very seriously. But at the same time as that, I feel like I want to stand in my power as a being, as a person who opened her eyes because I could, because I was given the privilege to, I was given the opportunity to, and I want to help others who maybe feel that for whatever reason at all, they have not been given the privilege or the opportunity to lift their chests to the world, to lift their chins to the world, to open their eyes to the world. I feel like I want to stand in my opportunity, my privilege, and my power in order to be of help to others. And it's so interesting that you bring that up, because isn't it fascinating that something that started out as being patriarchal and a little bit more male dominated has been energetically picked up. I'm not going to say taken over, because I don't think it's taken over. I think it's picked up by women in a bit more of a modern era, because in a way we have been given, if you will, a certain power that maybe is not as much afforded to men, which is to explore, to really have the permission to explore ideas that are of a deep, instinctive, and almost emotional nature. We have been given the permission by who, by what? Gosh, who can answer that question? So in a way, I feel as a strong woman, I feel privileged that my culture accepts the receiving, my particular culture accepts the receiving of this knowledge from me.
I totally agree with you. I have always maintained yeah. that men need, people who identify as men need a feminist movement, and it will not look the same, but what feminism gave women was permission to not do it the way it was prescribed.
Mm-hmm. Perfectly put.
And
yes.
Men need that opportunity as well.
Yeah. And it's interesting. So many of us stand in a place of such great self-awareness. Many of us stand in a place of being able to express, what we're aware of. And I feel like I've been privileged with the ability to be able to know what I think and to be able to express what I think. But there are so many people that are not even sure where they stand, what they feel, where they think, let alone being able to express it. And I feel that in this particular day and age, we strong women have been given, again, I don't know from where, a platform to be the mouthpiece, to be the one that uses their words and their inspiration in order to bring this knowledge into the world. And I believe that a lot of the men that are in the yoga community, of which there are so many and so many just great and strong and awesome ones, I feel are almost taking a little bit of a step back and allowing us to be, maybe you could say, the primary voice here.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
I have shared your link in the show notes so that people can access your primary voice offline. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that you have coming up where people can find you? What are you excited about in the spring, summer, autumn of 2018?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very excited about my recent book, One Without a Second, The Seeds of Yoga Philosophy from Root to Sprout. I'm very excited about it because I feel that it's a conversation rather than only a textbook where you're getting some information. I feel that it's almost like the reader and the author, who happens to be me, are entering into a dialogue. So I'm kind of proud of the voice of the book, the tone of the book. And my recent recordings, I did a chanting CD, very simple, but what I consider to be quite poignant, of all of the greatest, what I feel are the greatest hymns or verses that explain in a very concise way the importance of these teachings. And I'm very excited about the upcoming sadhana, deep sadhana retreat that I'll be doing with my colleague Catherine Beat from Yoga Space in Toronto, in India, coming up in January. Deep immersion into yoga philosophy and practice. I'm excited about that. And I'm writing a second book very soon. I'll be writing a second book, and I look forward to sharing that with my community. Those are the things that light me up these days.
And I can say with experience that your chanting is wonderful. It has been an element of my practice for a couple of weeks now. I've been enjoying it. And that's something that not everyone might know, is that the Bhagavad Gita is chanted. That is.
Yes, it is a song. Gita means song.
Yeah, the song of the Lord.
It's the song of the Lord, and it's the song that Krishna sings to Arjun, who is everybody, when Arjun is lying at the bottom of the chariot, which is the human existence, and not able to get up and do what needs to be done, which is called survive in this life. And then the master consciousness comes around and sings to you and says, you can do it. You're free. You're perfect. Here I am for you. Master consciousness, who is the you, who is you, says to you, who has forgotten it, come, we can do this. We can do this. And it all happens in song, which I think is cool.
It's certainly certainly a very delightful way to do that remembering. It feels easier. Or maybe
it does.
Easeful.
I agree with you. Yeah, easeful.
Thank you so much for your time, Hallie. I really appreciate it. It was a great conversation.
It really was. It was just so nice to connect with you and to talk as colleagues and as friends in a topic that we're both so excited and inspired by. So thank you so much for inviting me into this conversation.
My pleasure. And there are about 50 other things I want to ask you. So you'll have to come back.
We'll do it at some point. I will. I promise.
Good. Thank you. I got you on the hook. while recording.
Yay. Talk soon, Catherine. Thank you so much again.
That's all for this week, yogis. If you are in Ottawa, I have one spot left in my Ayurveda Night School course, Wednesdays in May. Other than that, I am slowing down a little bit with some of the education I'm offering. Teacher training starts next weekend, and a part-time teacher training running September to May begins again this autumn. You can always find out what I'm up to at www.intelligentedge.yoga. And just before we go, here's a quick note from Harvey. Okay, Harvey, what do you have to say? Oh no, they can't hear you eating the microphone. Okay. Harvey says hi. And now that's truly it. Namaste for now, yogis.